Hi, my name is Janelle Engelstad, and welcome to the MAP Radio Hour, a Make Art with Purpose podcast. The MAP Radio Hour includes conversations with creatives, scientists, and other people addressing the intersection of cultural, political, and environmental concerns. You can find out more about MAP and our projects at makeartwithpurpose.net. Today's episode features neuroscientist and musician Thomas Duell. Thomas is currently on medical staff at Swedish Hospital in Seattle. As a practicing neurologist and an epilepsy and EEG specialist, Thomas is also a sound artist and jazz musician, making site-specific installations and interactive music devices. Our conversation features music performed on the encyclophone, an instrument Thomas invented and uses in his research and in live performance. I'm sitting with Thomas Duell in Victrola Cafe in Seattle, and I first met you at a test party for Nine Evenings, and one of the things that interested me when I heard you talk about the work you're doing is that it felt like you're a neurologist and you have your practice, and part of that practice is seeing patients who have some sort of brain injury, maybe related to stroke or something else. And then there you have this side of you that's a jazz musician, and that they kind of merge together in this new instrument that you've invented, which you're calling the encephalophone.
Yeah.
So is that accurate description of what it is that brought those two parts of your life together?
That's pretty accurate. That's close. At least very close. So more specifically in neurology and in neuroscience research, I've been working with neurophysiology and specifically EEG, which is measuring electrical activity of the brain, or brain waves as some people call it. I have some formal music training in jazz composition and performance and music theory. And these things have been kind of fighting each other in my life for a long period of time. And I began bridging them a bit more when I did a fellowship at the University of Washington. I was doing research on music processing. So I was interested in how we process music cognition, how it's different from language, but how it's a form of nonverbal communication that we can use. And as I was studying this and using EEG, I'd seen other people who had done some work with sonification of EEG, taking EEG and turning it into sound, or making different types of music pieces using EEG. And I thought, I figured out a way that I could do it better, basically, that I could take what I knew about being an EEG expert and also working with brain-computer interfaces. And I decided to make a brain-computer interface that would essentially generate music with intentional control,
yeah,
or conscious control, or thought, if you will, using EEG. And it started off really as just a fun project that sort of was a nice way, as you put it, to bridge these two parts of me, the scientific and the artistic. But it's turned into a lot more, and I quickly thought of how I might be able to apply that to patients that I see in the hospital who have motor disability from various different causes. So, yeah, that's pretty accurate overall, I would say.
Thank you. jazz musician. Do you think, and so what you're doing, you're using jazz, you're composing jazz and using jazz in your therapy, but do you think if it was classical or another type of music, it would have the same impact, or is this just specific because this is the kind of music you play?
Well, there's two reasons for jazz. One is, yeah, it's the music I play and the music I love. The second reason is, just on a practical level, at this point, the encyclophone's accuracy is good but not perfect, and so it has to necessarily be improvisational. I'll be right, quote unquote, most of the time, but not all the time. And so I can't follow a precise melody line at this point. It's not, the control's not that good. So to follow a score in classical music, I wouldn't be able to follow the melody accurately all
right.
the time. And so it's an improvisational music, and jazz is an improvisational art form,
right.
A music form. Of course, there are others, but between me being a loving jazz and also it being an improvisational music, that's why jazz.
It suits the instrument and the therapy.
Although as a therapeutic device, I will make a point of finding out the patient's individual music preferences, because they will be most strongly motivated by the music they like.
So can you walk me through that a little bit? What happens when you use the instrument in therapy? What does that start to look like?
Well, we haven't done it yet, although I've done it with exactly one patient.
Right, and we saw that film of her at mm-hmm. the performance at Nine Evenings.
So I was preparing to work with patients when she came along, and she just was the perfect patient, so we went ahead with her. So reason we haven't started with patients is we're getting IRB approval, so we're getting institutional approval to do clinical trials in the hospital. In fact, we just got a grant with the NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, that will allow us to begin doing therapy with patients. But thus far, we've had one patient, and this woman came to the hospital when I was working, and I was on service in the neurology service, and she came in with a case of encephalitis, so an infection of the brain. But it presented, she noticed she had a problem when she suddenly couldn't sing and she couldn't hit pitches when she sang. She's a teacher and teaches kids music, among other things, and went to sing and just couldn't sing. And for a few days there, she didn't know what was wrong with her, but she knew that something had changed, and figured out that this might be a stroke or some kind of brain damage. And so she came to the hospital, and fortunately for her, she had no other problems other than having the inability to hit pitches. She didn't have any weakness, she didn't have any numbness, she didn't have any language problems. She could speak normally, and she could tell that she was off, but she couldn't hit the pitches. And we found that she had an infection, and fortunately it was stopped pretty quickly. But since she had this very specific problem, amusia, where you can't generate music, and she previously was able to, I thought she'd be a perfect case to try the encephalophone out, because it's essentially what I would be able to do would be able to use my device to help her generate music using a different part of her brain than the part that was lost, the part that was damaged. And so I'd help her use her motor cortex, the part that controls movement of her arms, to generate notes. And since she was able to tell the pitches apart, she could at least be aiming for the right ones, but wouldn't have to use the music generating portion that she had lost. And so we worked with her over 5 or 6 sessions, and we were able to see her improve. And now that's what we call an N of one. It's only one case without a control, so it's not, we can't prove for certain that her improvement wasn't an improvement she would have had on her own, but her accuracy increased, and she was starting to use some of the imagery that we were using in the encephalophone when she was singing, and she said it helped her. So, subjectively at least, I think we may have helped her out and helped her try to start rewiring her brain to generate music again. But what I hope to do with patients in general would be to patients who've lost some of their ability to move their arm, say, from certain types of strokes, but patients who still have that part of their brain functioning would be able to bypass the lesion that's causing the motor difficulty and generate music with that part of their brain. Once they get accurate with music, or they improve their accuracy, they get facile with the instrument, I'd then tie it to motor rehabilitation at the same time. So while they're generating music, they've been motivated and worked with the encephalophone for a while, and are now feeling comfortable with it, then we start trying to help them improve their motor skills as well. Besides the fact that I think it'll just be enjoyable for these patients, a lot of them will be bedbound for long periods of time without much to do in the rehabilitation wards, and they can do something really fun, especially patients who previously played music, but now perhaps because their arms don't work as well, they can't play piano or violin or other instruments, that they can now generate music and just get a lot of enjoyment out of it.
People using music as therapy for people with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
So they're able to somehow start talking or recalling memory or, you know, experiencing joy out of a state of maybe being more despondent or not even having some long-term memory, where they have long-term memory loss as well as the short-term. And I know there's a group in Dallas, and I've read an article somewhere about another group that's where music, this is just really, really helps to bring people into the present, mm-hmm. and remember at the same time. So it does have connections for us. I mean, I think it's probably instinctual maybe too. I mean, you look at every culture and you look at history, we have this thread of some sort of rhythm or music, whether it's drum beating or...
Yeah, it's you know? Evolutionary. We actually have some evidence that it's evolutionarily ingrained in us to do music. Every culture has music. And in fact, music forms an important role in a lot of cultures, not just in enjoyment, but in rituals, so births, deaths, marriages,
shamanic cultures,
war, celebration, and in grief. And so it performs a very important role. And a lot of that has to do with its ability to transmit emotional content quickly, and so a lot of these patients, maybe having music allows them to bring up memories, other memories, or become more present a lot because of emotional valence. So there's a huge emotional component to music, the right kind of music, of course.
Right.
If you play country music, somebody doesn't like it, they may not get the emotional attachment that you want, but most music's really very powerful, well known to be very powerful.
Performances, and you know, does your piece in that, and does it change depending on how tired you are or how what your mood is? I mean, you're sending brain waves, you know, and how is that connected to emotions or connected to space, or if you're cold or if you're hot or if you're you know, have a lights, I mean, does all that, can that change, and then that changes the whole improv and the composition of what you're doing? Or is that brainwave pretty consistent?
There are differences, so from day to day, depending on the the situation, and really, really comes down to two things. One is attention. So to the type of imagery I need to control the device really depends on a certain type of focus, and it's hard to describe, but it's kind of a meditative state. It's focused, but not too much intense. Can't try too hard.
Yeah.
A meditative focused state is the most important. So if there are distractions, or you know, even anxiety, if I have anxiety on a certain day, or you know, we're having a large performance in front of lots of people, or something's going wrong, those things changing from day to day can change my control. And so that was very interesting to try to work with, and I had to really kind of mentally prepare myself for that.
Right.
The other aspect is the signal itself changes a little bit, can change a little bit from day to day depending on where my electrodes are. I might have a different electrode placement, and so each day and each performance we do a different calibration of the instrument just to make sure that we were capturing that day's event, because it varies from individual to individual, but also from day to day, even within the same individual. So there were some really interesting things, and we learned a lot about the attentional part. You know, there was a big learning curve there,
right?
And especially in live performance, when there's distractions and lots of people around, and I'm trying to communicate with the other musicians, but also you know, technical things that I'm concerned about. I had to really enter a sort of meditative type of focused state.
The MAP Radio Hour is funded in part by the Lift Your Voice Advocacy Fund. Production by Matthew Horton. Theme song and logo by Otto Huditz. I'm Janelle Engelstad. Thanks for listening. And visit the Make Art with Purpose website to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.